This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 5th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Culture with Robert Bound, in association with Mercedes-Benz. Hello and welcome to the 21st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. And seeing as we're celebrating an important birthday, a journey into adulthood, key to the door and all that, we thought we'd celebrate by making this week's show as international as we can. We're whizzing off to the Marrakesh Biennale to ask whether the festival has managed to merge with the local art scene.
There is more and more audience. I mean, there were about 300 children running around this morning. So the curiosity is certainly there, and the word is spreading, that's for sure. So there's more and more people coming by every day.
We'll hop over to New York to hear about the fantastic Journal of Popular Noise, a music magazine that comes with a selection of 7-inch vinyl.
Each issue is a 7-inch record. It's all vinyl, and those are packaged in like a letterpress printed broadside that folds down to hold the three.
We'll find out how Palestinian film is making a comeback in Jerusalem and hear from the newly opened White Cube Gallery in Hong Kong.
What you'll find in White Cube Hong Kong space is an exhibition space that's sort of deceptively intimate. They're quite large spaces, especially for Hong Kong, and they're very large spaces. But at the end of the day, it has a coherent and cohesive feeling of being a white cube.
Plus, what people are buying at record shops in Paris, and a beautiful session from James Levy and the Blood Red Rose. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Well, before we get stuck into all that, let's start here at Midori House, where this week the fantastic James Levy and the Blood Red Rose came in and performed a beautiful Midori House session for us. And this, to kick us off, is Hung to Dry.
I left you hung to dry, left to die, da-da-da, da-da-da. I left you out for dead, let it be said, let it be said. I'm so sorry. If you need some time, we can meet up on Monday. Oh, Monday. If you consider me some sort of enemy, I'd understand. But I'm just a man. Oh, it would be unwise to take stance on that side, a declaration of the end. You say I've hell to pay, that's what you say, got hell to pay. Anyway, that's what you say. I left you out for dead, let it be said, let it be said. I'm so sorry. I've been all over town trying to find you, 'cause I hear you, man. Oh, I hear you, man. Still nowhere to be found. Your phone is dead and it makes me feel bad. But I don't feel that bad. If you consider me some sort of enemy, a declaration of the end. I left you hung to dry, left to die, left to die, da-da-die, da-da-die. I left you out for dead, let it be said, let it be said. I'm so sorry.
That was James Levy and the Blood Red Rose with Hung to Dry. The fourth Marrakesh Biennale has kicked off with a bang. The brainchild of British art aficionado Vanessa Branson has evolved since 2005 into a bona fide art world event. Its first 5 days are a multidisciplinary array of readings, film screenings, lectures, and, of course, art. On view until June is the Biennale's centrepiece, an exhibition called Higher Atlas. Taking place in five venues, it showcases 37 artists, many of them Europe's hottest emerging talent. But how does an arts Biennale fit into a country whose political and economic situation stands in flux? From Marrakesh, Kimberly Bradley takes a look at a vibrant, multi-layered, complicated event as the Biennale's opening week comes to a close.
Marrakesh evokes visions of souks and spices, hammams and idyllic riads. But last week, the popular Moroccan destination became a mecca for contemporary culture. With events in literature, film, debate, and visual arts, the fourth Marrakesh Biennale is more international than ever, thanks to the visions of founder Vanessa Branson, exhibition curators Nadim Saman and Carson Chan, and many other global and local collaborators. Carson Chan explains.
When we started planning the biennial, the exhibition, we really wanted to find a model for exhibition making that was local. And the biennial format is, you know, clearly a Western one. But what does exist in Morocco are festivals. And I mean, even between in the late summer months, there's 15 festivals a month, you know, so many, many festivals. And what these festivals are a combination. You'll have art, literature, theater, dance, music, all combined into one, you know, several day long event. And we've really taken that model on rather than, say, Berlin or Venice Biennial.
The Biennale also addresses the relevance of the arts in a country with issues like 40% illiteracy. Panel discussions see academics and writers discussing the imagery of Arab Spring. Films are screened at Marrakesh's Film School and the Bank Al Maghrib in the city's main square. Installations, sound pieces, and sculptures were created on-site by artists from places like London and Berlin, together with local craftspeople. To interact with Moroccan audiences and draw visitors into the city, many of the artworks are in public spaces, like a giant spiral-shaped interactive sculpture made of mud bricks and mirrors on view in the desert just outside Marrakesh.
I'm Elin Hansdottir. I come from Iceland, and I live in Berlin, but I'm residing now at the Dar al-Mamoun Artist Residency. And because I was invited to do something for the Marrakesh Biennial, I thought it would be very important to me to do something in the village next to where I live. So I decided to work with local craftsmen, and I wanted to learn how to build with these Pizé bricks, which, because the method really fascinated me, because it's just mud, water, hay, and brain, and manpower. There is more and more audience. I mean, there were about 300 children running around this morning. That's why the mirrors are so dirty. But that's fine. So the curiosity is certainly there, and the word is spreading, that's for sure. So there's more and more people coming by every day. I hope that the Moroccan people will benefit from this biennial.
The Biennale's events even integrate Moroccan performers like the singing group Al Giwan, who perform their traditional chanting and dances during opening week at the exhibition's five venues. Most of the artworks are on view at Theatre Royal near Marrakesh's train station. The massive structure was inspired by Moroccan King Hassan II's visit to the Paris Opera. He returned and wanted his own opera house. But the building was never finished, and the soaring main stage area and mezzanines remain a maze of bare concrete. It is a dramatic backdrop as cross-cultural as the event itself. Co-curator Nadim Saman, who himself is Lebanese-Australian but grew up in Hong Kong, explains a bit of what art means to Morocco.
Moroccans live with art, perhaps more so than, you know, many societies in Europe, because the notion of, like, the artisan is such an incredibly sort of stable and valued kind of profession and social group. You know, when you walk around the souk in Marrakesh, you see people hammering and painting and carving, you know, on almost every street corner. And so these skills are alive, the guilds are alive, you know. And, you know, when you walk into a Moroccan house, a real Moroccan house, you see the kind of the fact that everything is handmade and kind of hand finished. I mean, it's not about exoticism, it's about living with, you know, people, aesthetic products created by with people's own kind of by their own hands. So the thing is, we shouldn't see that as like exotic and somehow more authentic than Western contemporary art. But at the same time, we shouldn't feel like that this exhibition is an imposition of some kind of colonial taste on authentic Moroccans. Because who are authentic Moroccans, and who is an authentic European? What does that mean? This is about conversations that produce objects, be they physical or conceptual, that sort of bring people together and inspire. And I think this show has done that every step of the way.
Some artists have even turned Muslim culture on its head. Canadian artists Hadley and Maxwell created towers of scaffolding that echo the verticality of a minaret. From loudspeakers within them, we hear recordings of women's voices singing Arab love songs rather than the usual praying men. And let's not forget the Biennale's social side. Every day and night, festival goers meet at Riad El Fenn, a 17th century townhouse that Vanessa Branson transformed into a hotel and restaurant with lush interior courtyards. How has Branson seen the Marrakesh Biennale evolve, and where does she see it going?
So how I envisage it happening is that we'll always have a small core of official events, a main visual arts component. What is much bigger is the number of people who have been involved in making these projects, but also the parallel projects we've been encouraging, or many of the different arts organisations around here, but also quite a lot of people have flown in to do their own parallel projects. So I'm really thrilled with that, and I think that's the way forward.
That was Kimberly Bradley reporting from Marrakesh. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where it's time for our weekly media story. We're big fans of well-made magazines here at Monocle, of course, and we don't mind a bit of vinyl too. So when we discovered there was a publication in New York which combined the two, we got a little bit excited. Founded in 2009, the Journal of Popular Noise is a semi-annual audio magazine that celebrates the best qualities of both printed matter and music on vinyl. High quality and irresistible tactility. It's a record and a magazine, and perhaps above all, an artifact. Anyway, our New York editor Aisha Spears went to Brooklyn to visit Popular Noise and began by asking founder Byron Callett just what the journal actually is.
Basically, the idea is that it's, taking all the conventions of a regular traditional printed periodical and translating that into, how music or sound is composed and recorded and distributed. Each edition comes with three what I call issues, which are each issue is a 7-inch record. It's all vinyl, and those are packaged in a letterpress printed broadside that folds down to hold the three. Well, for each record or issue, I give a set of instructions to every artist or group or whatever. So, and these are instructions that are kind of based on the conventions of a template in a magazine. So that every in a traditional magazine, you have not only design-wise, templates that stay the same from issue to issue, but there's also sections, and within those sections, there's different, features or departments. And for every issue, the content switches out, but it maintains, this consistency from issue to issue. So it's the same thing in the records in that, I came up with a kind of basic pop song structure, and there's a diagram, and then there's some more specific and, kind of obtuse directions for everybody to interpret. And I kind of made it on purpose very clinical and authoritative looking and sounding, even though it's all completely arbitrary and really pretty straight ahead. I made it confusing on purpose because part of the process of people interpreting it is that they, will, if there's a word that doesn't really mean anything, but it sounds like it means something, it'll mean something different to everybody else. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the thing, other than there's the actual sound of what these people all do, which is different, which is interesting. But there's also the act of interpretation, which is sort of the more interesting thing to me. I like to see what people think I mean when I say dynamics or, whatever. Or there's a squiggly line.
Tell us what it looks like for someone. So if the beginning of a process, beginning of an issue, and you find the artist or the band that you want to work with, what is it that they're seeing that they need to interpret?
Part of the limitation of doing like a 7-inch record is that, first of all, you only have 4 minutes per side to maintain like the optimum sound quality. So for each side, I drew kind of a graph that's roughly, you know, inspired in equal parts by like John Cage and Brian Eno as much as like Muzak and these other weird scientific things. So there's a timeline along the bottom, and then there's like a line that goes up and down, kind of showing different, you know, a different dynamic range, you know, corresponding to at what point in the song structure it should associate with. And then there's different kind of other geometric shapes that kind of represent different layers of content that should, you know, be added in throughout the process. But really what kind of inspired it was I had this Muzak record, and they had this whole joke of a scientific reasoning behind it. And there's this chart on one of the records where there on the bottom it says time, and on the left side going up it says stimulus. And then there's just a direct straight line going from like the bottom left to the top right corner. Like there's no, it's nothing. I don't know. I thought there was something so dumb and brilliant about it, you know? So, and then there's also like on the whole, like that, so that's like the lowbrow end of the spectrum. And then on the highbrow end, there's like all the kind of like bizarro John Cage scores, which are, you know, like squiggly lines and totally abstract shapes that, again, like I spoke about, it's kind of, it's all about how like the different artist or performer interprets that to them. It's like totally arbitrary. Once I was, you know, working on design stuff in a more serious way, I really felt like there's a lot of overlap. Like in my brain, it felt like I was doing the same thing, you know, when it came to composing a two-dimensional, you know, image as well. It was like the same rules were at play. I got, you know, interested in magazines, and I really liked the idea of these like systemic kind of problems and how to solve them. It just kind of like, it kept feeling like I was running across things in design that reminded me of things from music. You know, the most obvious example would be like in Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, there's like this intro outro thing. And then you see the same thing in a magazine, you know, with like ending on these, you know, smaller, simpler things, and that kind of sandwiched like the bigger chunks. So anyway, like those kinds of ideas like all kept meeting each other in my mind. So I was like, what if we just tried it, you know?
That was Byron Callett from the Journal of Popular Noise talking to New York editor Aisha Spears. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're headed to Paris in a sec.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. It's time to visit an independent record store now to hear what's been flying off the shelves. And today we're off to Paris, where if you feel like buying a new record, you'll normally end up in one of the big megastores. But not far from the Bastille in the 11th arrondissement is Le Silence de la Rue, a friendly local music store. Since it opened in 1989, Christophe Ouelli, the shop owner, has been welcoming customers to explore his world of records and CDs.
We're in the east of Paris, not so far from Bastille, between l'Hôpital Saint-Antoine and Le Palais de la Femme. Le Silence de la Rue is created since late 89, exactly, 23 years old. It's not a mega store here, it's a human-sized store. And I think it's the most service we can offer in order to welcome people. It's equivalent between new albums and new projects and also reissues of back catalogue. Yeah, it's a 50-50 split. What means selling? Let's speak about the Black Keys album, for example. Huge, huge sell. Project The Other Lives, it's an indie rock band, and also the Brand New Air album. I appreciate and love the Joe Henry album, the new one. Bruised and blackened, hunkered down from sparking fuses underground. This is the producer of Tom Waits and is also the producer of the last Michel and De Goicello album. And this is a spectral ambience. It's beautiful, much more than beautiful. Faster hiding. One eye out for you.
That was Christophe Ouelli from La Silence de la Rue record shop in Paris. Still to come in part two, we'll hear more from James Levy Session here at Midori House before flying to an opening night in Jerusalem and Hong Kong, hailing the return of Book Corner and indulging in a glorious minute of sound from São Paulo. Gosh, what fun! So let's get straight to it from their wonderful recent Midori House session. This is James Levy in the Blood Red Rose with Walk Not Run.
Oh, I've seen the signs for all to come. So if I cry, please tell no one. When I leave, I'll walk not run. When I must go, I'll take no one. Fountain pen all dipped in blood, I'll sign my name, we'll drop our sun through the window, down through the trees, the shadows fall, woods misery. Yeah, oh, don't do it, do it, do it, do it, do it, do maybe I lost my way, and if you follow a big mistake, yeah,
It's been a long, long time since I've been cool. Those marching drums wither away. Yeah. Please don't judge me. You probably will. It's in your interest, babe, to let me be. Yeah. Please don't judge me. You're not above. But don't forget me, babe. What made me go?
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much.
That was Walk Not Run from this week's Midori House session from James Levy and the Blood Red Rose. And never to turn down the possibility of interviewing a band, Andrew Miller stepped up again this week to chat with James Levy and Alison Pierce of the Pierce's fame about how they came to end up working together.
I heard his music online on MySpace. I heard a couple of songs that ended up on the record, Painted Red and Crying to the River. And I hadn't really met him. I'd seen him around town, but and I kind of just thought he was
really good looking.
And then I heard these songs, and I was like, "Oh my God! There's so much more to this person than I thought."
He was very handsome, but who knew he could who knew he could sing and dance?
And I was so moved by these songs that, and I had this overwhelming feeling that like I had to get in touch with him, and we had to sing together. So I went to a show. And we chatted, and I told him my idea, and he seemed into it at first.
The reference that a lot of people have made on hearing the album has been to those duet albums made by Lee Hazlewood with Nancy Sinatra, and one of my favourite records, actually, that absolutely entrancingly insane one he made with Anne Margaret, The Cowboy and the Lady.
I don't know
which
if I've
is,
heard that.
I haven't heard that
it's
either.
It's a great
I've heard
record.
Someone else say that.
It's, but you had heard, presumably, the Hazlewood and Sinatra
yes.
oh,
yeah.
records.
Yeah, yeah.
Were they a conscious touchstone for this project?
Yeah. I'd say so.
They were, not with the songs, though. I think just with this, the...
kind of the feel and the style and just the...
Yeah, the song. Like
the basic feel we wanted people to get from the project.
What was it about those records that appealed to you? The Hazlewood
the style of it, just, the sexiness of it,
gorgeous.
The back and forthness of it.
They are. They're so sexy. Like, his voice and, like, that thing that they do with their voices with each other is just, like, it's hot.
Yeah, it's also the way they're not, I guess, conventional love songs. There's a lot of mocking each other mm-hmm. that goes on within the songs as well. Mm. They're like
it's
little
very playful,
like
yeah.
little dialogues, a yeah. lot of them. What were some yeah. of the other things you were sort of thinking of or listening to when you were writing and recording?
I think, for me, Scott Walker, maybe. I mean, to be honest, that was the two main things that we were going for. As far as, like, the aesthetic of it or whatever, I mean, a lot of these songs I wrote... like 9 years ago. But as far as, I mean, I was thinking like Neil Diamond and like Scott Walker and stuff like that, you know, little, you know, campy or something. But I don't even think it came out like that though.
Cause, yeah,
I mean, maybe a little bit, but.
Because as you were saying, some of these songs had appeared previously on earlier records of yours.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the thinking behind redoing those ones rather than writing new ones for this project? Did you just think there were other directions the old songs could be taken in?
No, when me and Allison, we recorded what, four songs,
mm-hmm.
and we really just did it for fun. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we came up with like a name, but I mean,
yeah,
we had this idea,
but we didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah, we weren't like,
but both of us also we were kind of. At a point in our careers where nothing was really going on. So, like, we definitely did not assume something,
no.
you know, that we were just kind of playing around on would actually happen when these careers we'd been working so hard on hadn't really done anything. So it was just kind of an idea at the time.
You mentioned Guy there, the producer, which is, of course, Guy Berryman of Coldplay. How did he become involved?
My other band,
I mean,
the Pierces,
you know better,
was working with Guy. We were making a record at the time. And I invited James to come by the studio, Electric Lady in New York, and I told him to bring, you know, some stuff for Guy to hear. Because I think James is such an incredible songwriter, and I just felt like his songs needed to be heard. And so I was always trying to help out when I could. So I had him bring a bunch of CDs to Guy, and he brought like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 CDs.
No, I did. Whatever.
There's an extensive, you know, catalog that he's working with. And Guy loved it.
Guy went through all the songs. He picked all the songs, really.
For this record?
For this record, yeah.
He chose the songs from your earlier
right,
catalog.
Right, so we had like four songs, and he got the idea, and he was looking for... He was like, do you have any other songs? I mean, we probably could have just sat down and wrote some more, but like... He just went through them, not really looking for the best songs, just looking for...
The ones that kind of worked with this.
And then Allison really liked a couple of them, and then I was just so happy someone wanted to work with me, to be honest. Do whatever you want.
That was Andrew Miller talking with James Levy and Allison Pierce, and we'll be hearing one more track from their beautiful session at the end of the show. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. A storied cinema has just reopened its doors after 25 years of being closed in the predominantly Palestinian part of Jerusalem. The Al-Hud Cinema is now on its way to becoming one of the major Palestinian cultural institutions in the eastern part of the city. It's part of a growing campaign to encourage and expand Palestinian film and culture, often overshadowed by conflict. And Joseph Dana went along to see the grand reopening.
On a bustling street just a few blocks from the gates of the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds Cinema stands out against the worn buildings with its brand new facade. The cinema's enormous windows welcome the odd passerby with an inviting promise of a film and a cup of coffee. Rania Elias is the director of Yabos, the Palestinian cultural organization behind the reopening of the Al-Quds Cinema.
We have three halls. Two of them are ready and used, which is Cinema Al-Quds, with 81 seats. The second hall is called Marrakesh Hall, which is a multi-purpose hall. It is equipped and the acoustic in it for music. The main hall, which is not ready, and it will be for the second phase, it is for 420 capacity with orchestra fit. The whole idea is to have it acoustically done for music. Our dream is to have the support for this hall and to finish it soon, because this is the main hall in the center.
To encourage the community, cultural events are priced at no more than 20 shekels, or roughly £3.
And the whole idea is to preserve the Palestinian cultural identity in the city, to present a quality of art for our audience in Jerusalem, and to be able to entertain people with different kind of culture, music, dance, literature, and other things. This was the whole idea, is to have an open place for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem, for the international and Arab artists to come and to do their events in this place.
Historically, Al-Quds Cinema was one of three theaters serving the Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, with films from across the Arab world. In the late 1980s, the historic building fell into disrepair, with the outbreak of fighting between Israelis and Palestinians and a rise in city taxes. Throughout the West Bank, similar theaters were closed due to lack of interest and the increasingly bloody conflict engulfing the region. Today, there are three single-screen cinemas serving 2.5 million people in the West Bank. Anas Muthafa is a Palestinian filmmaker who premiered her short film Peekaboo at the Al-Quds Cinema on the 25th of February. The 12-minute film was shot from the perspective of a baby traveling from Jerusalem to Ramallah through a myriad of Israeli checkpoints. She also presented Albire, a short film that she produced.
Because I called my company Jerusalem First Films, and because I'm a Jerusalemite myself, I said when I premiere my film, Peekaboo and The Well, they should be both in Jerusalem first. Because usually what happens in Palestine is that the premiere needs to happen in Ramallah. I'm not against it, but Jerusalem is my city, and this is where I want to premiere my film. I've already heard about Yabus, and I came with the two films, and I said, listen, I really want to premiere the two films in Jerusalem. Is it possible? And she said, of course, this is the whole idea of having a place like this in Jerusalem, and in less than 20 days it was organized, and I was really happy with the turnout. So I was so happy. I mean, I don't know how people describe their happiness, but like actually beyond happy. I hear felt really like a proper premiere, like a place where you can premiere your short film in London or Paris or anywhere else.
Despite the difficulties of creating films without cinemas to show them, the Palestinian film industry continues to grow in the shadow of the much larger Israeli film market. George Halife, a Palestinian film historian and producer, explains how the industry expanded without state infrastructure or funding to fall back on.
En fait, il n'y a pas d'État palestinien.
It is true that there is no state of Palestine. Knowing that, we can say that there is no Palestinian cinema. But cinema is defined by its content. It's an individual or collective point of view of a community or a film director. So in these cases, yes, the Palestinian cinema exists.
Dans ce cas-ci, oui, le cinéma palestinien existe. Bien sûr, du point de vue officiel, que s'il va.
But it is true that on an official basis, if the movie goes to Cannes Festival, for example, it will be presented as a French-Belgian movie or a German-Netherlands. But for us, if the film is made by a Palestinian, as a director, a screenwriter, or a producer, and if it talks about Palestine, therefore for us, it is a Palestinian film.
Soit comme producteur, il parle de la Palestine. Et alors pour nous, c'est un film palestinien.
The Al-Quds cinema is slowly attracting a loyal following of Palestinians and diplomats from Germany, France, and the UK, whose countries have invested heavily in the project. Currently, the cinema is not running every day, but by the end of the month, there are plans to have nightly films from across the world. In Jerusalem, culture is all too often overshadowed by the relentless Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But for the residents of East Jerusalem, the simple act of going to a film provides just enough respite from their politically charged lives. For Monocle, I'm Joseph Dana in Jerusalem.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to an opening in Hong Kong after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus, our weekly Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel and retail. Premiering this week, high-performance innovation from the biggest sporting goods trade fair in the world.
There's a real nice vibe for almost what we're calling gentleman explorer. Those people who used to go to the Arctic in just a jumper and an extra pair of socks and that beautiful styling coming through. So, yeah, some really nice heritage product.
You can find this and over 400 more films on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where, not satisfied with one champagne-fueled opening before the break, we've decided to go to another. The London-based gallery White Cube opened its first overseas branch in Hong Kong last week. Our Hong Kong editor, Liv Levitchnik, went to meet its director, Graham Steele.
Rumours about White Cube coming to Hong Kong have been abundant over the past year and a half. Now the gallery's finally here. When we went for a visit at the site at Connaught Road in Central, White Cube Asia's director Graham Steele had just finished hanging the works of British artist duo Gilbert and George, the opening show. We had a chat with Graham about the space and the ambitions of White Cube in Hong Kong.
And now we have the subject at hand, the Gilbert and George pieces. I think with Gilbert and George, and with this series in particular, for me, what is so fantastic about premiering this body of work here, in addition to the fact that it's the most substantive, the largest, the most hard-hitting body of work that they've ever done, but to premiere this work in Hong Kong shows such a huge respect for this audience and for the abilities of people to come in and wrestle with this work. This is not easy, Gilbert and George. I think what you'll find in White Cube Hong Kong space is an exhibition space that's sort of deceptively intimate. They're quite large spaces, especially for Hong Kong, and they're very large spaces. The ceiling height is higher than any other gallery in Hong Kong, but at the end of the day, it has a coherent and cohesive feeling of being a White Cube, so that we've exported the concept, we've exported the look, the professional feeling to what it is that we offer in terms of the spaces that our artists show in. Why we chose Hong Kong specifically was there was an opportunity, there was a kind of space in the cultural landscape here that we didn't necessarily see in, say, New York or Los Angeles or Sao Paulo or, God knows, Abu Dhabi or Dubai. The interesting thing here is there's not the same infrastructure of museums, of galleries, of private foundations, of collectors opening their homes. It's a very, very different way that people discuss art and look at art and live with art. And so it really offered us an opportunity, not simply in a commercial context. If we were thinking of it in a commercial context, we would have opened an office and shown pictures that one can put above one sofa. The point of opening a dynamic and challenging space here was to add what has become a very specific and very respected voice to a dialogue about contemporary art in Asia. And Hong Kong is very much a gateway in terms of business, in terms of culture, in terms of a kind of dissemination of culture, really, into Asia. And so it was something that made a whole lot of sense. And so bringing the kind of works and bringing the kind of artists that we represent will really add a great amount of energy and momentum to that dialogue. You can't walk into Tate Modern here. You can't walk into MoMA. You can't walk in. There's no South London gallery to show edgy contemporary art. So in a way, we have to be all things to all people, which is impossible. So what we're just going to try to do is bring the kind of artists that either haven't been seen here before, have been seen but a long time ago. So for example, Gilbert and George were some of the first artists to be shown in mainland China. So it's important for the mainland Chinese artists of a certain generation to see them return and to see their work progressing. At the same time as introducing them to people who've never heard of Gilbert and George. It's interesting how many people I've talked to say, Gilbert and George, well, and then you know, I bring a catalog out, they're like, oh my God, of course, I know that work. And so it's exciting to see how that audience develops, because it's a group of people that is an amazing mixture of incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly well-educated, incredibly hungry for a discussion of contemporary art. And so it's something that we are in a great position to sort of attempt to do the impossible by satisfying this hunger and this need for really fantastic, highest quality shows. Of course, we want to look at other artists from the region, and we will be bringing them in, and for the most part, doing a lot of shows with them in London, which will be fantastic. Opening concurrently with Gilbert and George in London is a dual show of two Chinese artists, Liu Wei and Mei Din. And I think it'll be interesting that we are premiering the White Cube, the London Pictures here in Hong Kong, and in a way then bringing part of that energy and excitement about Asia back to London. I am just excited to come in this morning and have seen the Gilbert and George works on the walls for the third day in a row, and moving them around and playing with their height, and feeling that it's home. In a way, this gallery is something that I've waited for so long. I can't wait for people to come in and see these pieces, because the show is so special.
White Cube's mission to educate and foster debate on contemporary art in Hong Kong is laudable. The gallery is a welcome addition to the city's cultural landscape, and it's sure to be a valued contributor to the fast-growing art scene here.
That was Liv Levitchnik speaking to Graham Steele of Hong Kong's White Cube. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Yay, Book Corner's back. We knew you'd missed it. It might not be making such a regular appearance these days, but we're all about quality and not quantity, right? This week it's the turn of Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, who wanted to read an excerpt from a new novel he's been loving. This is from Family Fang by Kevin Wilson.
Buster made the final strides to the edge of the stage with a previously unknown confidence, his heels clacking on the slick walkway, clack, 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 his rear swinging in time to the rhythm. When he reached his mark, he turned sideways, raised his lead shoulder, hand on hip, cocked his head, and looked out at the audience, who cheered. As he turned and walked back to the other girls, he lifted his hand just over his head, a gesture of farewell that couldn't be bothered to do more than acknowledge the fact that the audience was being left behind in favour of something much, much better. The other two girls looked at him, a stranger, no one they'd ever seen before, with nothing but bad intentions. Buster stared them down and then took his position in the lineup, the final three. Buster could hardly focus, his teeth bared as though he was about to eat a small animal. He was loving this, the glamour of the dresses and the shoes, the hair and the fingernails, the attention from people who didn't usually give him attention. The fact that, inside this costume, he was still Buster, which meant that, really, there was something essential inside him that made all of this work. It was a magic trick, and he had to keep reminding himself not to reveal the secret. Something so simple and easy if you knew how to look at it, which is what made it so magical. Blah, 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 aren't they lovely? Blah, 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 done so well. Blah, 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 they're all winners tonight. Blah, 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 second runner-up. Blah, blah, someone's name that wasn't Buster's, or not Buster's new name, Holly Woodlawn. Blah, 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 in the event that Little Miss Crimson Clover cannot fulfil her duties. Blah, 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 the new Little Miss Crimson Clover. Blah, blah, blah. And then there was an explosion of applause. Well, shit, Buster had blah, 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 the winner's name. He turned to one of his rivals and saw that she was crying. Had she won or lost? Had he won or lost? He looked into the audience, searching for his parents, but they were lost in the camera flashes and the spotlight that seemed to envelop everyone on stage. And then he felt someone's hands on his shoulders, and something so light that it almost didn't exist being placed upon his head. A bouquet of crimson clover was jammed into his hands. "Hug me," he heard the first runner-up bark, and he kissed her cheek and lightly placed his hand across her back. Now it was time for the inevitable, the thing that made Buster's crown art instead of artifice. They had rehearsed for days the different permutations of this event. Buster being dismissed immediately in the first round, Buster going out in the final 10, Buster being sent off stage when the final three were announced, Buster finding himself sashed and applauded, but not crowned, and, without quite as much vigour, they practised for this, the stage empty save for Buster, sparkling and shiny, the focus of everyone in the auditorium, a vacuum that pulled all air into his lungs. He waved as he had seen the women do in the videos, not actually waving, but instead turning as if mechanised and fully wound. Tears began to fall down his cheeks, the heavy mascara racooning his eyes and staining his face. He toed the edge of the stage, steady on his unsteady heels, and as he seemingly adjusted the crown, he leaned forwards, over the edge, bowing gracefully, and then snapped his body back to its original position. As planned, his wig flipped off over his head, skittering across the stage behind him, the only sound for miles. And then there was the sound of the entire audience pulling air into their lungs, necessary for them now to gasp, for some to scream, for the whole room too, as the fangs had dreamed, tear apart at the seams.
And that was Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, reading from The Family Fang by Kevin Wilson. Well, there aren't that many minutes left in the show, but there's a special one right here. It's time for this week's 1 minute of sound. Keeping the international, we're off to São Paulo, where Sheena Rossiter has given us a taste of the party season, which is in full swing. That was some spectacular sound from São Paulo. So that's just about all we've been able to squeeze into culture this week. I think I might have a sit down and a G&T. Next week, we'll be titillating our taste buds as we ask about the art of writing a good menu, and we'll hear from a New York restaurant with its own radio station. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This is the 21st International Birthday Spectacular, and it was produced by Katie Bulboa with the help of Hannah Jenkins, Dawn Trump and Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from their heart-stopping Midori House session. This is James Levy and the Blood Red Rose with Sneak Into My Room. It's number 501, by the way. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Well, I feel darkness and I feel rain. I want to kiss you, but I must refrain. I've already got someone to run to. I think you're pretty just the same. Oh, believe me when I say that society will make us pay. Oh no, sneak into my room, under the covers staring at the moon. And we can touch all night, Lie to your boyfriend, tell him what you like. Cause he's just a punk, and I'm in a funk.
Admit I feel the same, but if we kiss, then I'm to blame. I've already got someone to run to, but I find you pretty just the same.
Oh, believe me when I say that society will make us pay. Oh no, sneak into my room under the covers staring at the moon. And we can touch all night. Lie to your boyfriend, tell him what you like. Cause he's just a joke, that's all she wrote. Thank you.